Welcome, everyone. Welcome to the 6th annual Amherst Lecture in Philosophy. This series of lectures is organized by the Department of Philosophy and generously supported by the Forey and Micken Fund in Philosophy and Science. All the past lectures in this series are published in an electronic journal dedicated to this series and freely available at the website amherstlecture.org. We're delighted today to have with us Professor John McDowell, one of the most stimulating and influential professors, philosophers working today. He's a professor as well. Professor McDowell taught for a very long time at University College, Oxford, before joining the philosophy department at the University of Pittsburgh in 1986, where he is now university professor. He has held visiting appointments around the world, has delivered philosophy's most prestigious lectures, including the Locke Lectures at Oxford, the Woodbridge Lectures at Columbia. He is a fellow of the British Academy and a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Science. And just recently, he was honored with a Mellon Foundation Distinguished Achievement Award of $1.5 million, a grant awarded to individuals whose past scholarship has had a creative effect in their disciplines, the Mellon Foundation says, and on their own students, people who have affected the thinking of scholars in other fields and whose current work promises to make significant new contributions through both teaching and research, unquote. Professor McDowell has been showered with these honors because of his deep work in his major areas of interest, which include Greek philosophy, philosophy of language, philosophy of mind, metaphysics, epistemology, and ethics. Many of his papers have been published in 4 volumes of collected papers brought out by Harvard University Press, and he's also the author of, to my mind, one of the most stimulating books in late 20th century philosophy, Mind and World, which appeared with Harvard in 1994. At one point, Professor McDowell was asked what he thought was the job of philosophy, and he said this, quote, "My main concerns in philosophy center on the effects of a metaphysical outlook into which we easily fall at the point in the history of thought that we occupy. This outlook might be called naturalism or scientism. I believe it tends towards a distortion of our thinking about the place of mind in the world. The damaging effects show up not only in metaphysics itself, but also, for instance, in reflection about language and the philosophy of value and action. The task of philosophy, as I see it, is to undo such distortions," unquote. Today, in his paper titled Intention in Action, Professor McDowell will talk to us about some of his views about action. Please join me in welcoming him to Amherst.
Is this okay? I've done something wrong. Thank you very much for the introduction. It's a great honor to be invited to give a lecture in this distinguished series. I do think I need to say, picking up on something in the introduction, I don't get to keep the $1.5 million. A student of mine said, "So there's going to be a Lamborghini in the driveway." Yes, I have to spend it on good philosophical causes. Intention in action can sound like a technical term, and philosophers often treat it as one. But what I want to do is to sketch a way of conceiving something that one might mean by that phrase, intention in action, that we can be in command of just by being familiar with relevant regions of our ordinary language. Ideally, everything that I say should come across as just obvious, at least until quite close to the end, when I'll do something that you might think of as pulling a rabbit out of a hat. Maybe it'll still seem to you to be obvious at that point, and if so, yeah, by my lights, that's just fine. So, a way to start on isolating something that we might mean by that phrase, intention in action, might be to distinguish intention in action from intention for the future. An intention in action is an intention that's in the course of getting executed. So it's contemporaneous with whatever it's an intention to do, of doing that. And in that respect, an intention in action stands in contrast with a prior intention, an intention to do such and such at some future time. A prior intention predates the action that's its execution, if indeed there is any such action, as there won't be if the person who has the intention is prevented or changes their mind or forgets. One can do something intentionally without having had a prior intention to do it. One can act intentionally just on the spur of the moment. But we can ask, when doing something intentionally is doing something one had a prior intention to do, how does the prior intention relate to the intention in action that we implicitly acknowledge when we say the doing is intentional? And I'm going to begin working up to a picture of intention in action by considering an answer to that question, how do prior intentions relate to intentions in action, given by John Searle. I think Searle's answer is helpful as a contrast to a different picture that I want to recommend. So here's Searle's account in rudest outline. Intentions in action are new items that a prior intention starts to generate when the time to execute it comes. Prior intentions and intentions in action are different even apart from the difference in their temporal relation to stretches of activity. A prior intention has as its object an action, doing such and such at some future time. But an intention in action, generated by the prior intention at its due time, has as its object not the action the agent is embarking on, but something that Searle conceives as a component of it, so less than an action. I'll give you an example to bring out the flavor of Searle's conception. So consider an intention had by someone who's standing on a curb, the intention to cross the street when the light turns green. That's a prior intention. On Searle's account, when this person sees the light turn green, that intention starts to generate intentions in action. The object of the intention for the future is crossing the street. The objects of the intentions in action that it generates are the limb movements that need to happen if the person is to cross the street. As those limb movements begin, she begins crossing the street. If all goes well, she gets to the other side, thereby completing an action of crossing the street. On Searle's account, the action, the street crossing, is a causally structured complex. Its components are, first, the intentions in action that the prior intention began to generate when the person saw the light go green, and second, the limb movements on which the intentions in action are targeted, which the intentions in action will have caused. And so the street crossing itself is a causally structured complex containing intentions and limb movements caused by the limb movements. And the prior intention causes that whole thing, directly causes the intentions in action, indirectly causes the limb movements. Now, I think it's clear that that's a bit of philosophical theory, and that's not spelling out ways we learn to think just by learning to talk about acting intentionally. And I don't think Searle would dispute that. He'd say there are philosophical purposes for which his theory is needed. I'm not going to try to assess that claim, the philosophical purposes, directly. I've cited Searle's theory only as a foil to bring into relief a different answer to the question, how intentions in action are related to intentions for the future. I claim that the different answer is more natural, and if that's right, it can't be irrelevant to the philosophical purposes for which Searle thinks we need his theory. But I'm not going to go into that for its own sake. Searle is in view here only as a foil, as I put it. So, on this different account, when the person sees the light turn green and starts crossing the street, It isn't that an intention for the future starts to generate new items, intentions in action, as Searle conceives them. Rather, what was an intention for the future becomes an intention in action. When one starts to do something one had a prior intention to do, say crossing the street, one's intention, now in action, is still directed at crossing the street. It's not directed at the limb movements that need to happen if one is to get that done. When we say what the prior intention was an intention to do, we mention a time. In my example, when the light turns green. When its time comes, what was a prior intention takes a new shape as an intention in action. And again, I have to say, provided the agent doesn't forget the intention, knows the time has come, isn't prevented from acting accordingly, doesn't change her mind. So on this picture, contrast with Searle's picture, what were prior intentions become intentions in action. And that happens through the operation of an ability to keep track of time, so to, in my case, notice when the light turns green. One determines the time for acting as the time at which a recognizable thing is going to happen, in a case with that shape. One's intention is to cross the street when the light turns green. And then when that recognizable thing happens, and the subject recognizes that the time has come, the intention becomes an intention in action. That's just another way to say she starts doing what she intended to do. She still intends to do it. She starts doing it. The ability to keep track of time shows up in a really simple form there. And notice when some time specified in the future comes. Has more sophisticated forms also. And its relevance to a subject's psychological history isn't restricted to the way intentions persist through time, as I'm suggesting about intentions that start out as intentions for the future and then become intentions in action. The ability to keep track of time is operative whenever one keeps hold of time-specific thoughts as time passes. For instance, one can acquire at a time a bit of knowledge that one might express at the time by saying something like, the light is turning green. Then one can retain that knowledge. One needs to express it differently, that knowledge later. Maybe saying something like, the light turned green a while ago. It's the same bit of knowledge persisting through the passage of time that needs to be expressed in those different ways. Just so, it's the same intention persisting through the passage of time that alters from being an intention for the future to being an intention in action when its time comes. And again, I have to say, provided it doesn't lapse, provided the agent isn't prevented. Now, Brian O'Shaughnessy objects to Searle's conception of how intentions in action relate to intentions for the future. Several objections, but the one I'm going to begin with is O'Shaughnessy points out that at any moment, while one is, say, intentionally crossing a street, and stay with this utterly simple example, one has an intention that's still directed at the future. At any time during the crossing, one intends to go on crossing from the point one's reached so far to the other side. Now, this intention, the intention to go on crossing, isn't an intention in action in Searle's sense. This intention has as its object an action in prospect, right, going from the point one has reached to the other side of the street. Whereas the intentions in action that are operative in intentionally going on crossing, as Searle sees things, are supposed to have as their objects the limb movements that need to happen if one's to do that. Items that aren't themselves actions, but that Searle conceives as components of actions. Now, Searle responds to O'Shaughnessy with an acknowledgement that after one has embarked on doing something that one had a prior intention to do, an intention for the future persists into the time during which one is doing it, whatever it is. There's an ever-shrinking residue of the original prior intention, present throughout the time of acting, as an intention whose object is still in the future. In my example, an intention whose object at any time is to go on, right, from the point one's reached to the other side of the street. Searle writes, this is a suggestive wording, he writes of the remains of the prior intention. So it kind of shrinks as you get more and more of what it's an intention to do done. But Searle still distinguishes this shrinking residue of the prior intention from the intentions in action that bring about the limb movements that are needed for executing. When one realizes that the time determined for acting by the original prior intention has come, when one sees the light turn green in my example, the intention that was the prior intention starts to generate directly suitable intentions in action, and thereby indirectly to generate suitable limb movements. And from then on out, persisting in this increasingly residual form, it goes on indirectly generating limb movements by directly generating intentions in action as one goes on crossing the street. So the basic shape of Searle's picture persists through this acknowledgement that there's still intention for the future until you get to the end of doing whatever it is. And now this picture of Searle's presumably applies even where there was no prior intention. Throughout an intentional street crossing, even if there was no prior intention to cross the street, there has to be an intention of the sort that, where there was a prior intention, Searle conceives as a shrinking residue of it. But there has to be an intention directed at each moment towards an action that's still in the future, going from the point one has reached to the other side. Searle's picture has to be that whether or not there was a prior intention, intentionally crossing a street involves a shrinking intention for the future that progressively discharges itself by generating intentions in action that in turn generate suitable limb movements. That's really quite complex. Consider, in contrast, the simplicity of the alternative picture that I described. On my alternative picture, when one's intentionally doing something but one had a prior intention to do, one's intention in action is what the prior intention has become when the time is determined for action arrived. When its time comes and the agent knows it, the intention, provided it isn't thwarted and provided it doesn't lapse, takes on the new shape of an intention that's begun to express itself in action. And now the phenomenon that O'Shaughnessy points to, the directedness towards a diminishingly future stretch of action, falls straightforwardly into place. It's surely just what one would expect of a persisting intention that has become an intention in action because its time has come, and that continues to be operative in the acting in which it expresses itself. Similarly, with an intention that's at work in doing something on the spur of the moment, an intention, as we might say, that begins its career as an intention in action, rather than becoming one of them after a phase in which it was an intention for the future. So, to make sense of how a prior intention becomes an intention that has begun to be executed, I invoke the ability to keep track of time. The point I'm making now is that an intention that's being executed persists, directed at a diminishing future, through the time it takes to do whatever it is. And to make sense of that, we need not now the ability to keep track of time, but the ability to keep track of how one's action is progressing. Unless one's keeping track of how far one has come, one can't intelligibly intend to go on from there to the other side of the street. So these concepts work in a peculiarly simple form in the case of my example, which is why I focus on it. O'Shaughnessy himself draws more distinctions than I'm envisaging here. As O'Shaughnessy tells the story, there's an overarching intention of crossing the street, which may or may not have previously been an intention for the future, but which in either case persists in its entirety after one's begun crossing the street, though more and more of the street crossing it's directed at recedes into the past as one goes on crossing. But then there is, in O'Shaughnessy's view, in addition, a continuum, and that word has to be taken seriously, a continuum of intentions for the future, one for any instant during the period in which one's crossing the street, directed at progressively less extensive completions of the crossing. O'Shaughnessy conceives these future-directed intentions as caused by the overarching, persisting intention of crossing the street, and so as distinct from it. Now, with this continuum of future-directed intentions, one for each instant, each directed at a less extensive future, with that, O'Shaughnessy aims to deal with the phenomenon that Searle aims to deal with by envisaging the single shrinking intention, maybe a residue of what was a prior intention, intelligibly shifting in its future-directed content as one makes progress in one's action. But it seems to me that O'Shaughnessy's conception of the overarching intention of crossing the street is enough to deal with that phenomenon. This is perhaps fanciful, but let me say it. Unlike Searle's shrinking intention for the future, O'Shaughnessy's overarching intention stays, as it were, the same size. I mean, it has throughout the whole intended street crossing as its object. The extent of its directedness at the future shrinks, but shrinkage in its projected future is expansion in how much achievement lies behind it. And as far as I can see, this picture of the persisting overarching intention leaves unmotivated O'Shaughnessy's idea that there's also a continuum of future-directed intentions, each directed at a different remainder of the street crossing, caused by the overarching intention, and so distinct from it. Too many intentions. The shifting future-directedness is just what's to be expected of the overarching intention itself, and as it progressively finds expression in crossing the street. Instead of the notable intentions that O'Shaughnessy invokes, with their orientation toward smaller and smaller continuations of what one's doing into the future, we need only consider successive shapes taken by a persisting intention in action. And these are shapes having to do with how much lies behind, how much is still to do. The general form of this shifting future-directedness of intentions in action is this. At any time, one intends to do whatever is needed in order to finish doing whatever it is that one's doing. What could be more obvious than that? In my street crossing example, that idea functions in a peculiarly simple way. At any time in the course of crossing a street, what one still needs to do is to go on from the point one has reached to the other side of the street. But the same structure fits projects with more complex shapes, such as baking a cake or building a house. In these cases, when we spell out what's required of one to finish doing what one's doing, at a moment at which one's some way into doing it, we need to invoke things to do with more complex relations to what one has already done. Having beaten the eggs, one needs to fold in the flour, and so on, until the cake is baked. But the idea of going on until one's finished doing what one's doing fits for the content of the diminishing the future-directed intention that on the picture I'm recommending, an intention in action is. My colleague Robert Brandon says that intentions in action are special among intentions in being able to be directed at particular actions. And George Wilson, going further in what I take to be the same direction as that, specifies intentions in action as intentions directed de re at particular actions. And I want to spend a bit of time taking issue with that idea. Intentions directed de re at particular actions. It may be true of one that one is crossing a street, even though one isn't going to cross the street. It might sound odd, but think halfway over one's knocked down by a bus, or one changes one's mind and turns back. One's intention in action may be correctly specifiable by saying, I am crossing the street, even if one isn't going to make it to the other side. So there may never be a relevant particular action of the sort that figures in that specification of the intention in action, a street crossing in that case. There may be no action for the intention to be directed, de re, act. Reality comes to contain, so to speak, a particular action of the type describable as my crossing the street, only when it gets to be true to say, I have crossed the street. But by then, the time for the relevant intention of crossing the street to be an intention in action is over. I said a relevant intention because, of course, I may be engaged on another street crossing. When an intention of crossing the street is an intention in action, it has behind it at any point a stretch of action with the particularity that comes with completion, signaled by the truth of a claim in the perfect tense. One has moved to this point in the crossing, put it in a way that requires imagining oneself in the course of doing that. But an intention that's still in action looks forward also to a stretch of action that may never make it into reality as a particular achievement, right? Moving from the point one has reached to the other side. By the time there is a particular action of crossing the street, for a thought of crossing the street to be directed at, one has crossed the street. And now it's too late for the thought to have the character of an intention. So there's no coherent way to suppose that it's particular actions, that intentions in action are in. It must be wrong to think directedness at particular actions is the distinctive mark of intentions in action. I've framed the conception of the reality of particular actions that threatens the Brandon-Wilson doctrine in terms of a mode of thought to which tenses matter, actually more than tenses, aspect, but let me go on saying tenses. Actions are a species of events, and I'm urging an asymmetry between things that have happened, which I'm allowing as particulars, particular events, and some of them are actions, on the one hand, and things that are going to happen, or things that are happening, which I'm not allowing as particular events, particular actions as a species of events. And now, someone may want to object that from a tenseless perspective, there wouldn't be any warrant for this asymmetry. Think about that for a bit. Particular substances come into reality when they are, say, born or made. When they depart from reality, when they die or are destroyed. Events not quite like that. I mean, in contrast with that, it's natural to say that, like events of other sorts, particular actions, once they've acquired their particularity, that is, you can speak of them in the perfect tense, have the kind of reality that's appropriate to events from then on. They become part of history in a slightly peculiar but intelligible sense in which history can include events that have been forgotten. But in spite of this contrast, a point that particular substances go out of existence as well as coming into existence, whereas particular events, right, are there in a certain sense as soon as they are there at all, from then on out. In spite of that contrast, an asymmetry that corresponds to the one I'm urging for events shows up also for substances. Particular substances don't lose their particularity when they go out of existence. One can say of a particular substance that it no longer exists. Whereas things in the category of substance that don't yet exist aren't yet the particulars that, as we awkwardly say, they're going to be. And that's really awkward because maybe they're not going to be anything. Thinking ourselves into a tenseless perspective can't require us to hold that when we revert to the perspective of a thinker in time, we need to distinguish two different logical forms for, say, I am baking a cake. One in which a particular cake is in question, and one in which that's not so. Although at the time at which one might say such a thing, one can't tell which of the two forms one's saying has. And suppose I am baking a cake. Maybe a God's eye view from outside the temporal unfolding of events has in its scope a cake that's going to result from my cake baking. It'll be a particular cake, for sure. After all, there's no other kind of cake, as Fragan indeed might have said. But it can't be right to suppose that if that's so, right, so if I am going to make it to having baked a cake, then I am baking a cake, I mean a form that's intelligible only at a time-bound perspective, has a relational form amounting to there is a cake that I am baking. And if not, not. What one says when one says I am baking a cake isn't proved false if no cake results from one's activities. I was baking a cake, but I was interrupted and I never finished. And this independence of the truth of the statement, I am baking a cake, from a requirement that there be a cake that's going to come into existence, it's complicated, must characterize a form that such a saying has, even if a cake is going to come into existence as a result of the activities that are described by the person who says it. I mean, it can't be necessary to wait and see whether one's cake baking is going to be successful before one can know what logical form to attribute to one's statement, I am baking a cake. The logical form can't be captured by there is a cake that I'm baking. No doubt, after one's finished cake baking and has baked a cake, one can say, this, pointing, is the cake that I was baking. That's complicated. We mustn't take that to supply the instance that made it true earlier for me to say I am baking a cake, with that construed as equivalent to there is a cake that I'm baking. As if when the cake comes into existence, one gets to be in a position to follow up something amounting to there's a cake that I'm baking, right, after an interval in which one goes on one's cake baking activities, with saying something like, namely, this one, and now one can point. That's got to be crazy. Just so, at the time-bound perspective at which one might say, I am crossing the street, the logical form of what one's saying can't wait for a determination by what's going to happen. So that I'm crossing the street relates me to a particular action of street crossing, if there's going to be one, that is, if I'm going to get to the other side, and if not, not. The logical form of I am crossing the street has to be determinable from the time-bound perspective at which alone it so much as makes sense. And that requires us to say that such a statement doesn't relate me to a particular action, even if I'm going to get across the street, even if a particular action of street crossing is going to come into being. But now I'm assuming that I am crossing the street exemplifies the appropriate form for expressing my intention in action when I'm crossing the street. So it must be wrong to suppose that its being an intention in action consists in the presence of a de re relation to a particular action. While one's performing an action of a sort constituted by a terminus, like crossing a street, which isn't complete until one's reached the other side, one's engaging in various activities, perhaps moving one's legs in certain ways. Maybe, though this is iffy, classical scholars jump on me for supposing this, walking simpliciter, as opposed to walking from somewhere to somewhere. I mean, walking from somewhere to somewhere, you haven't done that until you've got to the second somewhere. Walking simpliciter, maybe not. Activities, in the relevant sense, occupy time in a different way from actions of the sort that are constituted by a terminus. As soon as one has embarked on an activity, the activity's all there, in a way that's indicated by the fact that one can attribute it with the use of the perfect. As soon as one is walking, if you'll allow me that use of the verb, one has walked. And of course that doesn't mean the current stretch of walking is over. When you look back, there is a stretch and one can allude to it with the perfect. Since the activity is all there at any moment, we can, if we like, conceive it as a race, right? Something de which, de re, some intellectual act or some such might be. And then it seems harmless to characterize a shape taken by one's intention in action at any time in one's progress across the street as an intention concerning one's current relevant activity, which is there, all of it, that it contribute suitably to crossing the street. As far as I can see, that's as close as we can get to the Brandon Wilson doctrine. We can see intention in action, if we like, as relating day ray to relevant activity. That's not to say that intention in action relates day ray to the action it's in. That was by way of being a kind of digression. I go back now to O'Shaughnessy. As I said, O'Shaughnessy countenances, besides the overarching intention of crossing the street, to stay with my example, a continuum of exclusively future-directed intentions, one for each moment in the crossing. And I suggested a simplification. Instead of those distinct, multiple future-related intentions, just consider the diminishingly future-directed aspect of the persisting overarching intention itself. There's enough there. O'Shaughnessy also envisages another set of intentions that would figure in someone's crossing a street, intentions directed at moving one's limbs in the necessary ways. The idea is that we have here intentions that reflect motor skills, not just the ability to make the movements that are needed for the routine exercise of a skill such as walking. I mean, it's so routine that it's maybe ambitious to call it a skill. But sometimes a more finely tuned responsiveness to circumstances. Imagine that not straightforwardly easy to walk across the street. One has to avoid obstacles, that potholes, whatever. But here we're closer to Searle's intentions in action than anything so far has brought us, anything in O'Shaughnessy's picture. But as O'Shaughnessy insists, these intentions, right, motor intentions, are still distinct from intentions in action as Searle conceives those. An intention in action in Searle's sense has as its object a limb's moving thus and so, which is not an action but a component of an action. Whereas an intention of this kind that O'Shaughnessy is envisaging has as its object one's moving the limb thus and so. And that's an action, not just a component of an action. But now, here too, I see no need to multiply intentions as O'Shaughnessy does. O'Shaughnessy conceives these detailed motor intentions as generated by the overarching intention, the intention to cross the street in my example, and so distinct from it. But we don't need to follow O'Shaughnessy in that. We can see motor intentions, rather, as shapes taken by the overarching intention as it expresses itself. In the picture, as I've already been pushing it, persisting intentions change their shape from being intentions purely for the future to being intentions in action, still partly for the future, when the subject recognizes that the time for acting has come. Once they've taken on that shape, intentions in action, they change to having less in prospect and more behind them of what they are intentions to do as an agent makes progress in a project. In the same spirit, we can say that these same intentions, intentions to do things like crossing streets, change from one determinate short-term motor shape to another as they express themselves in acting. Motor skills are anyway presupposed by the very idea of doing things like crossing streets. But in making the role of motor skills explicit, I've in effect added a third item to the background against which what I'm conceiving as the shifting career of a persisting intention is intelligible. Though I was already appealing to the ability to retain thoughts through the passage of time, and the ability to keep track of the progress of actions. The third item is the ability to move one's limbs as executing one's intentions requires. Those are all things on which what I'm conceiving as the changes of shape undergone by an intention to do something like crossing a street depend. Yep, there's a risk that comes up here, there's an implausibility that we need to avoid. In spelling out this idea of short-term motor shapes taken by intentions to do things like crossing streets, one's limb movements in walking surely aren't intentional under descriptions that involve the specifics of what one does at a given moment with the movable parts of one's body. I mean, normally competent walkers don't know what they do when they walk at that level of description. What we can say, perhaps, is that one's movements are intentional under specifications like whatever it takes, right? Moving as walking requires. Maybe moving as stepping over this obstacle requires. Then ordinary competence in moving determines which movements, described in terms of what one does with one's limbs, conform to such specifications. That determination isn't a task for the practical thinking that intention belongs to. Okay, so far I've been diverging from O'Shaughnessy in rejecting the multiplicity of intentions that figures in his picture. I want to differ from him in another way as well. O'Shaughnessy doesn't allow the title, intention in action, to any of the intentions he countenances. He thinks there's something wrong with the very idea of an intention in action. I've been working with the thought that we might refuse to count as intentions in action the items that Searle applies that label to. Intentions whose objects are that one's limbs should move in certain ways. But that we might apply the label to different candidates, in particular to the persisting overarching intentions that O'Shaughnessy himself acknowledges, intentions to do things like cross streets and swim the channel. But O'Shaughnessy would have no sympathy with that. The label just disappears from the field if O'Shaughnessy has his way. This skepticism about the very idea of intention in action is, in the first instance, directed against the way Searle uses the notion. With intentions in action as Searle conceives them, it's not just that they are not prior to the actions they're said to be in. Right? That's just temporal. That wouldn't be objectionable by O'Shaughnessy's lights. Searle's intentions in action are supposed to be in the actions in another sense, besides that merely temporal one, not prior. They're supposed to be components of them. And O'Shaughnessy finds it unintelligible that anything deserving to be conceived as an intention might, as he puts it, and I really like this phrase, enter into the precincts of the action itself. It's a sense of a sort of sacred area. Unintelligible that an intention might be in the precincts of the action itself. And that has implications that are more general than hostility to Searle's picture. Intention might be in an action by being a component of it. If we accept O'Shaughnessy's prohibition on intentions entering the precincts of action, we have to suppose that the intention of crossing a street, right, to fix on the single item to which I've suggested we can reduce the multiplicity of contemporaneous intentions that he countenances, we have to suppose that that intention, the intention of crossing the street, relates to someone's crossing the street only from outside, right? Not in the precincts, outside the precincts. Compare, perhaps, how an intention that a tree should fall might be conceived as related to the tree's falling if the intention is realized in one sawing through the tree's trunk with the result that it falls. Now, I don't want to defend Searle's idea that intention might be in action by being a component of it, but I do want to resist any suggestion that the relation between intention and action is appropriately modeled on the relation between an intention operated in sawing through the trunk of a tree and the tree's falling. Understood in such a way that, to echo O'Shaughnessy, the intention doesn't enter the precincts of the falling. I mean, that seems like a fairly intuitive thought. The intention doesn't enter into the precincts of the falling. I want to urge that the intention of crossing a street, conceived in the shape-shifting way that I've been describing, shouldn't be conceived as related to one's crossing the street, only from outside. I'm going to spell this out by exploiting another region of O'Shaughnessy's thinking, namely his groundbreaking work on the will, a giant two-volume book of that title, The Will. In that work, O'Shaughnessy presents a dual aspect conception of physical or bodily action. That's the subtitle of the book, A Dual Aspect Theory. General shape of it is like this. Acting physically, acting in a bodily way, is exercising motor capacities. And exercising a motor capacity is just as such a bodily phenomenon. But according to the dual aspect conception, it's also psychological. And not just in an isolable component, but through and through. A psychological concept, expressible by willing, tailored to a use that O'Shaughnessy tailors it to, applies not to some supposed psychic initiating occurrence, but to the relevant bodily goings-on, the ones describable as a subject exercising a motor capacity, in their entirety. So both physical through and through and psychological through and through, that's the dual aspect conception. Willing, in the relevant sense, isn't something that causally initiates bodily acting and maybe supervises it from outside. Willing is in the acting, not in the sense that willing is part of an action, but in the sense that willing is a characterization of the acting itself, apt for capturing its psychological aspect, which is one of the two aspects that it has. That's O'Shaughnessy's dual aspect conception of the will. Now, O'Shaughnessy is impressed by the thought that willing, conceived like that, belongs to animal life in general, whereas intending doesn't. Intending isn't universal in animals. The way O'Shaughnessy marks this restriction is by saying intention can be attributed only to animals whose behavior is future-directed in a certain distinctive way. Example, consider a cat slinking along, belly to ground, whiskers twitching, in a way that can be explained by saying it's stalking a bird. The explanation implicitly invokes a projected future in which the bird has been caught. If we say it's stalking a bird, we're answering a version of the question why, in terms of which G.E.M. Anscombe famously isolates intentional action. And in fact, that example of the attribution of intention to animals other than human beings is Anscombe's own. So, the concept of intention has more restricted application than the concept of willing, as O'Shaughnessy uses it for the psychological aspect of the thing that should be conceived in a dual aspect way. And that's so even before we consider the special form in which the concept of attention applies to rational animals, a special form that comes into view when we consider actions whose agents are responsive to the question why, as the bird-stalking cat, of course, isn't. Now, O'Shaughnessy accommodates this distinction between intending and willing. Willing is just acting. By holding that intending is additional to the willing, that according to the dual aspect conception, just is acting, conceived in a way that brings out its psychological aspect. So he says things like this: intending belongs to a higher region of the psychological. Intending isn't merely psychological, but mental. And the idea is intending causally initiates willing, that is acting, and supervises it. And now we can say, from outside its precincts, it doesn't get into the precincts of acting itself. So what to make of that? Well, we certainly have to acknowledge that the idea of intending is different from the idea of willing, plain and simple, like willing as it's found in animals that don't have intention. But do we have to agree with O'Shaughnessy that intending is additional to willing? It's an alternative option. Conceive intention in action as a special form taken by willing as O'Shaughnessy conceives it, in animals that do things intentionally, as not all animals do. That would allow us to go further than O'Shaughnessy does with the dual aspect conception of bodily action. Conception of bodily action is both physical through and through and psychological through and through. If intention in action is a species of willing, then like the willing plain and simple, to which O'Shaughnessy restricts the concept of willing as the psychological aspect of something to be conceived in a dual aspect way, it can be in action. Right? Not now in the Searle-like sense that it's a component in acting, but in an O'Shaughnessy-like sense, that intending just is acting, characterized in a way that captures a now more sophisticated psychological aspect that this kind of acting, intentional acting, has, and extending the dual aspect conception to include intentional acting, intentional bodily acting. It may seem a problem for this proposal that willing, as O'Shaughnessy conceives it, just is acting, whereas intending turns up not only in the form of intention in action, but also in the form of intention purely for the future. Intention purely for the future can't be just what willing is, that is acting, characterized in a way that brings out its psychological aspect. I mean, the whole point of calling it intention for the future is the owner of the intention isn't yet at it, isn't yet acting. And then here's the thought, surely intention in the course of being acted on should be just what intention purely for the future is, except that its time has come. And that seems right too. But everything depends on the direction in which we take that equation. I mean, as a sort of program for explaining concepts. We might think the equation requires us to base a conception of intention in action on an independently explained conception of intention purely for the future. And of course, that would threaten the possibility of supposing that intention in action is a species of willing. Right? That intention in action just is acting, described so as to highlight its psychological aspect. But we do better to center our conception of intention in general on intention in action and frame our conception of intention purely for the future in a way that suits how intention in action is best understood. So the other way around. Start with intention in action and then work to intention for the future. Once intentions purely for the future are in the picture, we're concerned with rational animals. We can say an intention is the kind of thing that can be arrived at by practical reasoning, though intentions don't need to be acquired like that. And now practical reasoning can be for the future. I can deliberate about which bus to take tomorrow. I'm imagining myself in Pittsburgh with an errand for the next day. And then I can conclude by forming a specific intention, the intention to take the bus that leaves at 8:30. But that shouldn't dislodge us from holding that when practical reasoning is about what to do now, drawing the conclusion is acting, as Aristotle says. It would be better to say drawing the conclusion is beginning to act. Intention for the here and now is, if you like, a kind of thought. It's thought that's practical in the sense that assenting to such a thought just is beginning to act in a certain way. For instance, starting to cross a street. Going on assenting, not revoking one's assent, is going on acting. For instance, going on crossing the street. An intention for the future is by all means a thought of the same kind, apart from the time difference. But the way to accommodate that isn't to separate intention for the here and now from acting on the ground that intention purely for the future isn't acting, which is true enough. But to conceive an intention for the future as a potential action, an action biding its time. When its time comes, provided the agent knows its time has come and isn't prevented, provided she doesn't change her mind, it will become an instance of willing, that is, acting, dual aspect conception. And on these lines, we can hold on to the extended version of the dual aspect conception that I was envisaging We can say intention in action is the form taken in intending animals by willing, which we can conceive in an expanded version of O'Shaughnessy's way. Intention in action just is the acting that it's in, under a characterization that brings out its psychological aspect, a psychological aspect that's more sophisticated than the one captured by talk of willing, plain and simple, captured actually by putting the idea of intention in the context of the question why, as Anscombe does. This picture of intention for the future as potential action, action biding its time, is no more than an application, now in the context of the extended dual aspect conception, of the idea that I urged at the beginning of this lecture, the idea that intentions for the future become intentions in action when their time comes, provided, etc. According to the extended dual aspect conception, talk of intention in action is just talk of acting intentionally, framed so as to emphasize its psychological aspect. Since there can be intentions for the future, acting intentionally can be, though it needn't be, the mature form of something that was already present before acting was underway. So we might say an intention for the future stands to the acting that one engages in when one starts to execute it, but more equivalently to the intention in action that it becomes at that point, as a caterpillar stands to the butterfly that it becomes in metamorphosis. So I've been talking about intentions as a kind of continuant whose instances change their shape as time passes. They persist through time, changing shape. The first kind of shape-shifting I considered was the shift from intention purely for the future to intention in action. That's what I've just proposed redescribing by saying that an intention purely for the future is an action in waiting. It matures into an action in progress when its time comes. So action in waiting is something whose essential nature is that in due course, failing prevention or change of mind or losing track of time, it takes on the shape of action in progress. That's what's natural to that kind of critter, and something like the way in which it's natural to a caterpillar to mature into a butterfly. The second kind of shape-shifting was in respect of how much of what an intention is an intention to do has been done, and how much remains to do. That changes as time passes. The third was in respect of the specifics of the more or less skilled bodily movements that an agent is engaging in at successive moments in the execution of an intention to do something like crossing a street. And here my suggestion has been that to talk of an intention in action as a continuum that changes its shape as time passes is just a way of talking about the unfolding of an action intentionally undertaken. Now, I want to end by stepping back and saying something very briefly about reasons to be interested in the possibility of incorporating intention in action into a version of O'Shaughnessy's dual aspect conception of bodily action, contrary to his own view. He thinks intention is extra to the psychological aspect of the dual aspect thing. I suggested a way of conceiving it as a sophisticated form of the psychological aspect of the dual aspect thing. As O'Shaughnessy notes, this is why he refuses to go the way that I've suggested, a capacity to move limbs at will belongs to animals in general. It isn't special to rational animals. That can make it tempting, perhaps almost irresistible, to conceive facts about practical rationality at work. I mean, including the full-blown intentional character that a bit of behavior is marked out as having if its agent is responsive to Anscombe's question, why? Conceiving such facts as just additional parts of the truth about bodily behavior in the special case in which bodily behavior is engaged in by a rational animal.
and on this view, which I'm saying, really natural to be really tempted by, movings of limbs that are intentional are in themselves just what movings of limbs are in an ordinary animal. The intentional character is added, extra. It's natural to say lies somehow behind those goings on, the limb movings, which in themselves have nothing to do with rationality. And then the overwhelmingly natural way to cash out the image expressed by a use of behind like that is to conceive operations of practical rationality as causally related to one's movings of one's limbs. Now, I've set against that a picture in which, I've just given a picture, I haven't argued that we must have it, I've just set it out. I've set against that a picture in which, when bodily behavior is intentional, the bodily behavior is itself informed by practical rationality. It isn't just a result of the operations of practical rationality. I'm taking that to be just a way of saying the intentional character is not extra to the intentional character is just the psychological aspect and the extended dual aspect conception. Now, this extended dual aspect conception seems clearly attractive in at least two ways. I think these two ways are connected. I'm simply going to plonk them down and then stop. First, if we can see rationality as in bodily activity, as opposed to behind it, we have a vivid contrast with a familiar picture, according to which a mind, at the seat of its owner's rationality, occupies a more or less mysterious inner room, concealed from the view of people other than the mind's owner. Right? The mind is out there in the bodily activities that are palpable to other people also. Second, if bodily activity can be rationality in action, as opposed to a mere result of exercises of rationality, that stands in vivid contrast with a similarly problematic tendency to distance one's body from one's true self. It's natural to connect one's true self closely to one's rationality, right? But then if the rationality is not in the bodily behavior, serious questions arise about the relation of the self to the body. Okay, thank you for listening patiently.